Okay, we'll adjourn the meeting of the Mesa Housing Authority Governing Board. And we'll call to order the study session for Mesa City Council, Thursday, December 11th, 2008. First item on the agenda is to continue with the budget presentations. And before we go, before we continue on with this, I'd like to maybe update a little bit, or provide an update a little bit to the process we're going through. For the last, what, three meetings now, we have heard presentations on adjustments, changes, reductions, however it is that goes into our budget for the current year and into the 09-10 budget session. And there's been, I guess, some questions exactly what we're accomplishing here. And what we're really trying to do is get an update from some departments, not all, but from the major departments and areas as to how we are going to both confront the crisis we have now, the financial crisis we have now, and also how we're going to establish changes in operations that will help us in the future, both through the next 18 months and then beyond. These are some items will take in effect with this council's approval in January. Many of the items will be phased in. So this is really the beginning of a process, not a process in and of itself. And as we hear these reports, there's a lot of questions that council members have had. There's a lot of things that as we've given the reports and discussed them further that we realize that we will probably tweak, and it's opened up other areas that we realize we need to look at. And I know a lot of the council members have had questions for staff outside these meetings as the presentations have been have gone on. And we're going to take those questions, and when we come back in the first of the year, we will go through a formal budget process where some of the items I'm sure will be open for further discussion. We'll touch on other issues that have been brought to light through these discussions, and this is a multi-part process. I don't want everyone to think that there's some sort of hidden thing and more layoffs or more changes that are not being brought up. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm saying that we're making some major changes in how we do business in this city, and that's not something we take lightly, and it's also not something that you can do in a 4 or 5 week period. We didn't choose the method in which we're having to respond to the situation we're in. That was sort of thrust upon us, but we're willing to take on that responsibility, but we recognize that it will be a work in progress as new questions are raised, as observations are, and as we try things and we find out that maybe we can do something a little bit differently or a little bit better. So as we go through these presentations, please understand that we have many questions up here. We are grateful that city management and staff have put a lot of work and thought, and the city employees have offered input. And you know, there's still some things that are not 100% resolved that will be resolved as we go through the further process. So I just wanted to maybe update. Now, how we're going to proceed is that today we have a presentation from a couple departments. We'll have a summary from Mr. Brady. Now, next Thursday, we'll come in and summarize the whole thing. And at that time, there are some issues that I know council members would like to bring up, and we'll discuss the overall and how this all fits together, because we have not really seen how all the parts fit together. So we'll do that next Thursday. Is that correct, Mr. Brady?
Correct. And next Thursday, we'll be asking council to give formal direction.
Formal direction,
to,
yeah.
To move forward with these changes in the budget. That's
okay,
correct.
So we'll have a chance to bring in other areas that we have not heard from, questions that have come up, and then have some formal direction from the council to move forward with the immediate changes.
Right, and actually by the last item today, if there are items that need to be further considered, we probably need to get direction, some feedback today,
so
we can prepare those.
Okay. All right, so beginning with that, we're going to have the Development and Sustainability Department. And the reason why they're coming back up is that they did a great job and followed instructions perfectly on the presentation, which was great until we ran out of time. And so we sort of left you hanging as far as some of the specific impacts that your proposed changes will have on the budget. So we ask the department to come back and basically just finish up what we had run out of time for on the previous day. So, Ms. Solanka?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Council. We are going to continue the discussion that we had last week, talk more specifically about the economic impact the development services has seen, the reduction in our activity levels, our current budget, and then the specific numbers that we're talking about for the future. One of the things that we really try to use as a predictor of what activity is going to be across the board are pre-submittal cases. And this is when the initial cases actually come in the planning area, the initial conversations with developers. This graph shows you just the tremendous drop-off that we have seen even in the last couple of months. Last year, when we were talking about activity levels, we were holding pretty strong, particularly in our commercial area. We'd already seen a significant fall off in residential. But as you can see here, particularly from August through November, just a tremendous decline in pre-submittal. The other thing that we're seeing is even the cases that have been coming in, and again, the pre-submittal is just early on conversations about what development requirements are going to be, what the developer wants to do. We've not seen those pre-submittal cases turn into actual cases coming through for zoning or site plan. Looking at revenue in the planning division, this is basically a comparison year to year with the monthly numbers here. The 08-09 is the sort of turquoise color here, and as you can see again in November, we're down almost 50% in our revenues associated with planning cases. October was down 40%, and you can certainly see a decline this year compared to the last 3 years. This is a consolidated slide. I think it's always important in the building safety area. It's somewhat confusing to look at total numbers of plan review cases versus revenue. And the line here is showing the revenue decline, quite frankly, was drastic in November. We were down just to $280,000, from over 600,000 the previous month. The numbers also of cases that were coming in, and this compares single-family residential, which has been down for well over a year now, but comparing that to commercial, and if you see again the significant decline in commercial that we've had this year compared to last year, and again a significant decline in the revenues that we're seeing. Again, just looking at the revenues by themselves here in November, very consistent with what we were seeing in planning, down just under 50% in what our projected revenues had been. September, we had a pretty good month. We had a couple of big cases come in, but again, October and November have been down significantly. Based on the cases that we're seeing come in, our projections are that we will continue to see a decline. One of the other areas that we always track is our building inspections. And again, this is once a project is complete, when we have our inspectors out there doing the construction inspections through final certificate of occupancy. These numbers are still up compared to our preliminary planning cases and our plan review cases. Our projection there is that these numbers are, the inspections are lagging a little bit behind the projects that we've had in over the last 6 to 9 months. Are now coming through to completion. The inspection stops are still up a little bit, but we're projecting that the construction inspections, based on the amount of work that we don't have coming through the queue, that we are going to see a concurrent fall off in those inspections over the next couple of months. These are the bottom line budget numbers that we are proposing. I'm sorry.
These graphs, are those by month or are those cumulative? Oh, it says cumulative year. Maybe if I read the title. I'm sorry. Cumulative year to date. Sorry about that. Never mind.
These are the proposed budget reductions that we are looking at for the rest of fiscal year 08-09 and 09-10. The target reductions for the remainder of this fiscal year, just over $3 million. And then on an annualized basis for 09-10, based on the reductions that we're proposing, we're looking at just over $6.3 million. The bottom line on numbers of positions that are being eliminated, we're looking, starting at approximately 136 total positions and across the department, 71 positions are proposed to be cut. We'll have a remaining number of employees of 65. So that's the basic summary on the activity levels and the budget numbers and the proposed reductions. And if there's any discussion or questions at this time?
Yeah. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Christine, I still continue to have a concern over the reduction in code compliance positions as well as the consolidation of code compliance with building inspections. It would seem that in difficult economic times, the need for code compliance would grow and not shrink in terms of difficulties people and businesses may have in terms of maintaining their properties. And then second, more as a comment, combining code compliance with building inspections is really taking us back to the days of DISCO, because back in the 1970s, these functions were combined in the city, and it was a model that didn't work and was abandoned by the city because the building inspectors simply did not want to get involved with neighborhood leaders, neighborhood groups, dealing with people and interacting with other city staff and law enforcement. So I'm hoping this can work, and that the training and interdisciplinary tasks that you're going to provide for people will work, because this is a model we got rid of over 30 years ago because the functions simply either clashed or the personalities clashed. And then my other concern is, again, I think code compliance problems will grow in bad economic times, and we're reducing the staff. And I think that will have a counterproductive result for us in terms of law enforcement, stable neighborhoods, and things like that. Thank you, Mayor.
Vice Mayor?
I just want to echo that of Councilmember Kavanaugh. There is a definite concern about how the neighborhood interaction is going to take place. And I hope I'm proven wrong and that my fears will be allayed, but there's really a concern of how we make sure that those building inspectors take an active role in the neighborhoods and not just think their job is to go and look at things and walk away. So I hope we're really being proactive in that regard.
Councilmember Finter?
Ms. Galanca, we've had quite a bit of feedback and correspondence with regard to fire plan review. Could you tell us a little bit more information with regard to the fire protection engineer that's in the fire department and how that would probably be able to work?
Sure. We actually have representatives fire here, so Rich, if you wanted to come up. We have a fire protection engineer who's a registrant in the fire department, and we've actually had a very collaborative working relationship with that individually. He works for Rich Kachansky, our fire marshal. We have monthly scheduled meetings with fire to talk about fire code and building code issues, cases that are coming up, problems on interpretation. Rich has made a commitment to us that Hal will continue to be available on a consulting basis. As he has been, we don't expect any change in that working relationship, but we've just felt that we needed to make sure that he was still going to be there. We currently have the ability to consult with that fire protection engineer if we've got a specific situation that's a unique code issue. We're looking at a code modification. Steve Heather is our deputy building safety, and he actually is going to be our designated building official. We can sit down with Hal, work through those issues. We've also gotten a commitment from Rich that as we are changing individuals and we've got some reorganization going on, that Hal will be available to help with cross-training. One of the goals that we have is that we actually have more depth in fire plan review, that we have more of our plan reviewers that are knowledgeable about the fire code. There's an awful lot of overlap between the building code and the fire code. If you remember the last time we brought the fire code changes forward, we spent probably close to a year collaborating between fire and code to make sure that those were totally aligned and we didn't have something that was different in one code. So we've always had that collaboration. We have agreed that we will continue to have that collaboration. The fire code is equally important to other aspects of the building code. We have critical life safety issues as far as structural, electrical, that our plan reviewers are responsible for, and the fire code portion of it is an issue of training. We talked last time of maintaining certifications, making sure that we do have training available for people, whether that's in-house or through the ICC classes that are offered. There's face-to-face classes, there's online training available, and our commitment is to continue to keep the people at the top level that they need to as far as qualifications, and that we're going to do even more to provide more in-depth ability within the department on fire plan review.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins.
It's just kind of a comment. My concern is the end result of something missed in inspection during our training, and is the fire department catches it before they get their certificate of occupancy or whatever that stage is. And so it's already been built, and it falls on the developer to put the outlay of money to bring it into conformance.
Well, so one of the issues there is that the plans that are submitted must be sealed by a registrant, so a professional engineer or an architect. So the plans that we get in from the developer, they're the ones that really have the first line of responsibility to make sure that they're building in compliance with the code. So we never stamp plans. We review them for compliance with the code. But you're absolutely right. And that's why we do the construction inspections during the course of construction, so that if there's something that shows up out in the field, if there's an anomaly, that we catch it. One of the issues we've actually talked with Rich just recently is that we get some of his fire prevention engineers involved early on some of the really large projects, so they know what the building looks like early on before it's all buttoned up. When they go in and do their annual fire inspections, they already have a pretty good understanding of what those facilities are.
And I think it's important to understand that the process, we're not devising plans, we're not creating plans. We are, if the development community and the professional community is doing their job, our job should be very simple. We're basically reviewing professionals. Mm-hmm. We're not reviewing amateurs. Every set of plans that come in should have been prepared and reviewed and certified, basically, with that engine. And just so people understand that whenever a plan's submitted, the professional engineer, when we say stamp it, they actually stamp and sign and take responsibility.
Absolutely.
For those plans. And therefore, it's their responsibility to meet their professional standards. Now, the truth of the matter is that sometimes engineers, architects, others try to take the most, let's say, most economical route to get places and may, you know, push the line. And I believe our job is to make sure that as they find the most economical, that it also meets the minimum standards that we require through the code, and that they meet those standards of safety. But the fact of the matter is they are prepared by professionals, they are certified by professionals before they come into our office. Is that that's accurate, right?
That's absolutely
okay,
correct.
Okay, just
we won't
sure
accept
we
them
that.
If they're not signed.
Right. So we're reviewing professional work. Okay, we're not. Okay. Councilmember Richens?
In some respects, this department is the front door of our economic development activities. And the one concern I'm starting to get already is I'm already starting to hear excuses for poor performance blamed on layoffs and shorthandedness. We can't have that happen. We need to make sure that we institutionalize good performance, good, you know, no excuses just because we're shorthanded, that we give the same good service that we've always given to developers or even better. But it's starting to the chatter about that is already happening, and I've had people that are interacting with this department already hearing excuses from inspectors or other folks because of the layoffs. If you could make sure that we get the training that everybody needs so that doesn't continue to happen.
I absolutely will.
Thank you.
Councilmember Summers?
I have a concern about what happens when we start to recover from this outright free fall in the economy and start to bounce back. My hope is that we don't just recover, but we explode out of the gate, which means we're going to see that chart you had of the fall off and pre-submittals flip around and start to go up. I don't know how quickly you can expand the organization again and get those new folks online and trained in order to handle that. And I suspect that you have an element of how we're going to handle this expansion at some point here in the plan, which you state in a letter to us, said we will be expanding the use of private contract service to meet specific project needs, and particularly in specialty areas. So we're looking at outside contractors as a way to be flexible. So what is the internal plan, or do we have one yet, that that talks about who will be able to sign off on these things as for the city Will their plans have to be reviewed, or will they be receiving training in Mesa's building and fire code, the private contractors?
That's a great question, and actually it's an issue that we talked with the Developers Advisory Forum yesterday. That's our stakeholder group that we meet with on a regular basis. We met with them yesterday morning and talked through this whole program, the impact that it was going to have on development and what our commitment was to make sure that we maintain the level of service and the customer service that we, I think, are known for. The plan that we have in place to respond to the rapidly developing upsurge when it comes, we've got a couple of things. Outsourcing or using private contractors is something that we've always done. We've had outsourcing contracts for plan review. 50% of our budget in the environmental area has always been for outsourcing contracts so that we can respond to increasing need when we have it.
People understand, there's an industry out there that offers these services. It's not just that we go out and pluck somebody off the street. They're actually firms and individuals that's what they do for a living. And in fact, there's many communities, especially on the West Valley, that have an outsourced city engineer that is not a city employee and serves as a city engineer for four or five different communities. So this is not something that we are just doing. This is very common in the area as cities and especially smaller towns struggle to meet this fluctuating demand. So there is an industry out there of people that this is what they do for a living. So,
right. In fact, I spoke with several engineers yesterday who hadn't been working with us previously, and they were very interested in participating in that program. One of the conversations that we've had with the city manager is that our job at this point in time is to get those folks on board, which we're working on doing, to have even more of the outsourcing or outside contractors available, that they start working with us so they do understand the city system, they understand the nuances of the amendments that Mesa's made that's maybe a little bit different than Gilbert. One of the other ways that I feel that we can respond if we get an upsurge that's not sustained, we've got a number of employees who have indicated a willingness to come back on a temporary basis. And we're actually doing something a little bit different there that we hadn't done before, that we could bring prior city employees who have been doing a great job, that we're not happy with the fact that they're not going to be here, but that they've indicated a willingness to come back. We feel they can help not only with plan review, but inspections and even permit services. If we get loaded down where we just can't handle it with the remaining staff, that we can bring those folks back on a temporary basis very quickly.
Are those employees that are retiring, or are they just out of work? Because if they're out of work, you know, they might find some other employment, or what group are you talking about?
We're actually talking about both of those. We have several employees that have actually opted to retire. I've talked to numerous employees that potentially this could be an option even on a part-time basis. Someone could review a set of plans at night or on the weekends. They don't necessarily have to do it 9 to 5. So we have a number of employees that are interested in doing that. You're absolutely right, though, particularly over time. We're hoping certainly that the employees that are having to be separated find other employment, and gradually we're probably going to have to rely more on the outsourcing contracts.
Councilmember Summers?
Yeah, two more items really quick. First, again, it goes to the point, and you alluded to this in this conversation, that the codes, while there is the ICC, there are model codes available. Each city, when they adopt them, tends to tweak them one way or the other, the building code, the fire code, the plumbing code, all of them. And so an architect or an engineer needs to be aware of what those little changes are. So how do we propose to prepare? Are we going to create a group of Mesa-certified plan reviewers or architects, and what's the policy for that? And with regard to that as well, are we just going to be, are we going to hand out the reviews? Do you have to go through an RFP process? What bureaucratic nightmare might come of this? How are we going to avoid the bureaucratic nightmare for going out into contract?
Okay. I've used consultants for many years, and reviewing the qualifications of consultants is critically important to make sure that we have the right people on board. Steve and Tammy are currently working with our purchasing department, and we will ask for requests for qualifications, and we'll make sure that we have identified individuals that are familiar with the codes. The city codes actually are published out on the website, so our particular modifications are knowable. They're out there. They're publicized. Folks that work with us now have to understand what our local modifications are to the standardized code.
Well, let's put that in perspective also. It's not like Mesa has a code that is so drastically different. I mean, does everyone follow the IBC now, or is
the ICC?
Still,
IBC root beer.
It's early morning. But, I mean, we're not so drastically different. There are tweaks. There are subtle differences. There's maybe one or two areas where there might be a difference. So the base knowledge is pretty consistent across the board. And as a matter of fact, a lot of, especially here in the Valley, MAG, Maricopa Association of Governments, has established certain standards in the engineering, for example, that are accepted system-wide, so to speak. So, you know, as far as that goes, most of our changes are, as you said, knowable. Is that a good new word today?
But Mayor, if I might, the question really is, and I don't think there's going to be a gross difference between us and Tempe where there would be significant structural changes, but there are enough of these changes throughout codes where you end up with a problem. You go to one reviewer, you hear one answer. You go to a second reviewer, you hear another answer.
Which leads me to my concern, which is very similar. Yeah. And I think from a technical standpoint, I'm not concerned with our ability to attract people who know the code and know their business, because they're all professionals. I hope they do, and I've worked with enough of them out there. That to me is the easy part. I'm really concerned about the service part.
There you go.
I've dealt in cities where they use outside contractors, and the inconsistency of service is what I'm very concerned with. I understand that you have one of the most difficult challenges. You know, we're dealing next with the fire department. Their level of service doesn't really change a whole lot drastically with the economy. I mean, we still have fires, we still have medical emergencies, things like that. You go up and down, and you have to somehow react to that. And, you know, it's like you showed us in your graphs, it's drastic. And the choice is we can maintain people and just literally pay people to sit around, and not by their fault, but they're just not the business coming through the doors. And I don't think that's prudent for anyone. And I think that we would be rightfully criticized if we had a large group of employees with virtually no work to do because there just wasn't the activity in the economy. On the other hand, as Councilmember Richin said, you are our gateway. And if we are to achieve our goal of truly providing economic opportunities and become more facilitators to our development partners rather than simply reviewers, because when we're reviewers, we're not providing good service. And I'm really concerned that we have outside contractors who are contracted to review. And somehow we need, and that's easy to do. I mean, we can hire all sorts of people to review. The hardest thing is to hire people who will facilitate, meaning help our development partners get to the level where they're complying. Not tell them what they have to do, but sort of tell them what they get to do, and facilitating their efforts so that we can truly be the area or the city where people find it easy to do business. Not because we're applying a lower standard, but because we are literally assisting them in achieving that standard. And that's a real concern of mine. And I don't know how we get over that other than as we go through reviewing these outside contractors, I would hope that we sort of take the Southwest Airlines approach to things, and that is that you can teach anybody in the world how to serve a soda pop. What you can't teach them how to do is how to serve it with the kind of level of interaction and human skills that make people feel like you enjoy serving them a soda pop. And that's a real concern of mine as we go forward. So,
yes. I actually have some ideas on that.
Hold on. Okay. You know, this is I think that we have that challenge. These are the same comments we get before with city staff. You know, it's interesting, the dilemma. It's like, at the end of the day, it really does become an attitude and it becomes an approach that we have to either take time working with our own employees about the facilitation versus the review perspective, or whether it's a contractor. I even imagine that there will be times because of the workload, and we can only hope, we're only hoping that this day will come right now, that we have to hire additional help, that they are maybe literally sitting down in the same, you know, cubicles next to our own folks, and we work on that. I know we have that challenge. We're going to have that challenge whether we had all city employees or whether we have city employees and contractors. I think it's just a culture and a direction that I think Christine and Steve and Tammy and all the folks are committed to doing. And it just takes constant, you know, reminder and acknowledgement that that's what we want to do, is we want to be the facilitator, not necessarily the obstacle course through which people have to make it through. One of the things we are committed to doing, though, is not necessarily waiting until there's a turn in the economy or in the building activity to bring these contracts on, these outside sources on. I think Christine's talked about bringing them on now and begin now while we have some level of work to do to begin making sure they understand how we do business and what our expectations are, because it's going to be a lot more difficult if things start to pick up and we're getting busy to do that. So we want to start in, you know, finding those outside resources that we can bring in now and begin that dialogue and training.
And I think the challenge is that when you're going to outside contractors, you are putting out requests for qualifications, and those tend to be a list of technical qualifications. And because they're not in those cubicles day in and day out, it's much more difficult to integrate them into a service model. So I'm hoping that that one of the qualifications is, and perhaps at the top of the list, because my guess is that if you have 8 firms, 7 of them are going to meet the technical qualifications, but you probably only have 2 of them that'll really meet the service qualification, because that's just how it works. And I think it becomes much more of a challenge with outside contractors.
And that's going to take time, and yeah. That's why we want to start now, to get that experience with and find out who those contractors are that they have that are out there that get that point, and that we can be comfortable with as we move forward.
Vice Mayor.
And I appreciate that discussion coming forward, because that's been an issue that I've had for 6.5 years is the service aspect of it, because we keep getting stories. And I want to make sure that we don't lose the small people in here. It's not just the big contractors and stuff, but the individual who just wants to add on a room or close in a carport or something, make sure that they get treated appropriately, because even recently we've had some issues of people coming to me of concerns of how they've dealt with the city. So we still have that challenge. And it's going to be even a bigger challenge with the reduction, but we need to be extremely proactive in our interface with people and how they feel like they are treated. Doesn't mean they're always right, and we know that they come in and expect the world when they haven't done their part of it. But we need to make sure that we help them understand what they need to do, instead of making them feel like you should have done that. And again, it's all in the approach, and we need to be real proactive on that.
Councilmember Richens.
Just to get back to your presentation, and we're doing it to them again. We're pulling them off their presentation, not able to get through anything.
I was really at the point here where I thought we probably just needed to have
okay,
this
good.
Session.
I just had a question about one of your slides, the proposed budget reductions.
Uh-huh.
In the last column, it says proposed fiscal year 08-09 FTEs. I'm presuming that's for after January, the continuation of the fiscal year. Does that also, is this the staffing plan for 09-10 as well?
Yes, the staffing cuts that we're proposing here, the separation date that has been agreed to with city manager is January 9th. So these reductions will be effective, January 12th for the remainder of this fiscal year. And then at this point in time, we're hoping that this is the organization model that we have for next fiscal year also.
Thank you.
Okay. In accordance with Mr. Richens' instructions, please continue with your...
Actually, the rest of it are more organizational issues and kind of our process that we talked about last time. So if you don't have any further questions on those, although I have 2 things I wanted to say, if that's okay.
No, you'd be off the...
That's right. We have to follow.
You got to sleep today,
well, no,
we'll get
upset. It's in response to the discussion here. Number one, the issues on code compliance and the responsiveness to neighbors.
Oh, yeah.
We absolutely understand how important that is. Tammy Albright has already started working on that, and I think, quite frankly, that Tammy brings a unique personality to the table and the ability to work with the neighbors. She's great at doing that. She will have the combined inspection group, and her huge challenge, quite frankly, is to make sure that the building inspectors who start taking on some of the code responsibilities absolutely get on the bus, that is the critical part of their job. And I honestly think that one of the things we're doing here, we're taking folks that are out there in the community and we're taking the blinders off. We're saying, okay, as you're going down a street to a construction site, and I think I showed one of our examples last time where we had a very poor structure that was built at the back end of a house and was clearly a life safety hazard, that those people will be able to proactively identify code issues out there. Tammy has already set up meetings with neighborhood services. She'll be working with your council assistants to start forging those relationships. But you're absolutely right, and I understand completely how important that is. And my commitment there is that we will continue to keep that as a very high priority. And if we need to improve, if we need to propose something different, if we find that we're not quite making it, we will be back with options.
And Mayor and Council, we understand that. We understand that code compliance is a significant representative in the community. You know, we came up with this model and an ability to be able to, again, going back to the other concerns we were just talking about, to respond when development comes back, that we were able to retain more building inspectors than we would otherwise do. If the building inspectors can't find it easy enough to make that transition to being that community-friendly co-compliance officer, and the activity levels in building inspection isn't there, then we'll have to make changes. We'll have to bring in individuals who get it. But I believe that Tammy's pretty persuasive and will be able to help them understand how important it is to be. And really, you know, in the end of the day, it would be great to have building inspectors who get it too. That at the end of the day, if we grow back to where we were, and we have cross-trained building inspectors so that when they are busy, when they're doing building inspections, they can be co-compliance officers too.
And I think that you have a challenge here.
Yep.
And I think that's what we're trying to say. Because even though it sounds like it's the same thing, it really is a different skill set. Building inspectors generally work professional to professional most of the time, unless they have a small backyard project or something. But it's professional to professional. Code compliance generally works professional to citizen. And that's, in many ways, is it requires somewhat of a different skill set. However, it's all about, like Mr. Brady said, it's all about people and understanding and working with people. I hope that we use this as an opportunity to move away from the technical side of things, because once again, that's trainable. What's really not trainable is how people interact with other people, that you either have it or you don't. And I'm hoping that as we look for people, that we get the right people in the right place. I mean, it's been said by an author that building a great organization is not about putting people in place, putting the right people in place. And sometimes that takes second place, especially as we're going through these cuts and everything, where we tend to focus on technical skills. We can train technical skills all day long. We can buy technical skills in the open market. It's hard to find the right people. So, and I know you know that, and I'm sort of speaking to the choir, but especially in this case, we'd like to overemphasize that service, I think we're going to be looking at as a number one priority, simply because that's how we're going to build this better community, is by getting people into the system, getting them through the system, and allowing them to more readily and more easily be able to move ahead with their investment, whether it be an addition on their house or whether it be a 3,200-acre master project. At the end of the day, they're all the same, and we got to provide that service. Councilmember Higgins.
Christine, I just wondered, you're usually really good at getting input from the development community and the advisory forum. Did you have time in this process to get their feedback on how they felt before you showed them the plan?
Obviously, that's a little bit of a challenge, because we wanted to make sure that we, number one, had a final plan that we were going to be able to propose, that we get the information to council, that we got the information to our employees. So we had the Developers Advisory Forum yesterday morning. We had that scheduled for about a week and a half. We did this the last time also. When we went through our last RIF back in the spring, we scheduled actually two meetings of the Developers Advisory Forum to talk about these things. One of our major goals there is to really find out what their priorities are. Two of the things that we came up with last time, the pre-submittal process, some people love the meeting, some people hate them, so we said, okay, you can opt out of the meeting. So we got that feedback. They also talked about civil plan review, and that was one of the major frustrations, that they saw inconsistency in staff between their initial discussions and then when they went through final plan review. So one of the changes that we've made here is that we've got the development planning and the civil plan review together. There will be one individual going from the beginning to the end. As you know, and we appreciate you being there yesterday, thank you. We had discussions on processes. There are certainly concerns from the development community. We have talked to some of our major employers that were there yesterday. We were actually talking about some special funding possibilities with those folks to make sure that if they want a higher level of service than we can normally provide, and this is sort of the DMB model, quite frankly, that they can come in, they say, you know, we want this level of service. You can only get out there within 24 hours. We need you out there in half an hour. We're talking about actually splitting some positions between maybe four or five employers where they actually pay for additional positions. So those are the kinds of discussions that we've been having. We will continue to meet with the Developers Advisory Forum. We currently meet on a quarterly basis, but we send emails out to them all the time, letting them know what's going on. And certainly I have a number of them that are very comfortable calling me personally, calling Steve or Tammy to talk about specific issues that they may have or challenges. But our commitment to the development community has always been that we will try to be as transparent and as open as we possibly can and get their input.
Okay.
I had just one other thing.
Sure, go ahead.
I wanted to talk about the customer service and the outsourcing. I just want to make it clear that we don't outsource customer service, that my responsibility is to make sure that we are continuing to provide that level of service, that flexibility with our developers. And part of our job is to manage those outsourcing contracts. It's not just, here, take these plans and get back with our applicant. It needs to come back through us. We need to make sure that we have a very close understanding of what's going on between our contractors and our applicants. And that actually came up yesterday with the developers, that some of the outsourcing folks think that the city is their customer. Well, my perspective on that is the applicant is still the customer there, and that's the one that we need to make sure that we're providing that level of service.
And I hope that you, as you're outsourcing, you hire people. If somebody thinks that the city is their customer, they shouldn't be one of our contractors.
I agree.
You know, it's as simple as that. That's about getting the right people. Right on, they need to understand that they are an extension of the city. Because if you're an applicant coming in, you don't care who does it. The city is looking at your plans, regardless of who cuts the paycheck to the person who's actually has the red pen.
Right.
So I appreciate the challenge you have. Like I said, your challenge is much different than most of our departments who are having to deal with either a permanent change in their service model or a change in the level that they have. You have to plan for both. You have to deal with the reality now and plan for the potential of a significant change that could happen fairly quickly. So we recognize you have a unique challenge, and I really appreciate what you've done. You've taken some bold steps, some of which were sort of thrust, most of which were thrust upon you, but some of which I think you've looked at, obviously, with the idea of how can we set something up now that will serve us in the future. We understand that, you know, some of these things will probably work like perfectly, and some of them we'll look at and we'll say, gee, you know, that probably wasn't the right way to go.
Right.
But we need to be bold in trying some new things, understanding that they may or may not work like we think. I would hope that we'll continue to monitor those. I know that from hearing the comments from the council that there will be a continued interest from all the members of this council, because these are the things we hear from, probably more than anything else. As you have development partners who are more than willing to call and share their ideas with you, we have the same thing. They're more than willing to share it. And so we're ultra sensitive to that, because this is who we hear from, and this is who we should hear from. You know, as we go through and try and create this this increased level of economic development, these are the people we need to come in and invest in our community. So we need to be take extra special care in making sure that they come in, and that our citizens, if they want to add that carport or does anyone add a carport anymore? I guess not. Add that room.
Accessory living quarters is what they add.
Okay. That they also feel as though they're not pushed to the back of the line, and that creates a special challenge for you as you're trying to adjust to varying levels. So thank you very much. There's no other questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. The next department up is fire department. Nobody's coming up. Okay.
Mayor, while the fire department's coming up, let me just want to make sure that the council understands there's a significant effort has taken place over the last couple of weeks to come up with this proposal, and I think it's important for us to recognize the significant effort by both the fire department as well as our labor representatives from the fire department who've sat down together and I think come up with a pretty bold plan that attempts to both address how we look at the model of fire department, of services in the fire department, as well as trying to achieve some of the cost savings overall. And I just want to say it's not, this is somewhat unique where we have such a great partnership with our representatives from the labor side who were willing to sit down in some pretty long meetings from what I could understand over some consecutive days to come up with this. And I really think it shows that we have a very unique opportunity to work with a great group of professional men and women in the fire department who really are looking after the best interest of the city. And I just want to express my appreciation to them and their efforts and to the chief and his staff for what they've done. And then on top of that, this really shows to me the really the heart of the fire department. As we know, and we just talked about, that many of our very great employees, loyal and dedicated employees, are being affected by these layoffs. And as an organization, we've actually set up a city employee care fund where employees are contributing to help these employees during this holiday season. And I just want to publicly thank the fire department, the labor, for donating $1,000 to that fund. That was a significant contribution. We just want to say thank you for what they've done. Chief?
Okay. Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Mayor, Council. Thanks for the opportunity to present the plan that we have based on the challenge that we have to address a current financial crisis we're involved with, as well as the future service demands and our ability to sustain our service levels into the future. Before I get started, I want to introduce on my left here is Dan Stubbs. He's assistant chief in charge of our operations division. He has the job of managing all the kittens in the basket. He has all the fire response vehicles that are running all over the street all day long. And so, as you would imagine, it's a significant challenge, and he does an outstanding job for us. He's going to help answer some questions. To my right, Radonna Orlando is in charge of our management services area and manages virtually all of the budget stuff, and as you know, in the last several years, that hasn't been a simple task. So, and kind of to tie into maybe the previous presentation a little bit, you know, it's important for public safety that we have a very active and a very capable building safety department. As you can imagine, they are really an extension of public safety. They perform an office function. They aren't in the street. But what they do has a direct impact on the safety of the public as well as safety of firefighters who depend on structures to behave in a particular way because they've been built under a code that they understand. And certainly neighborhood services, the council's done an outstanding job understanding and I think recognizing the need for better neighborhood services because what goes on in those neighborhoods can easily times turn into public safety issues. And so I just want to give a vote of confidence to the staff in those two areas for the great job that they do. Before we go on with the presentation, I want to echo some of the things Chris has said and I really recognize the fire union, especially Brian Jeffries, the president of the local, for his leadership and the hard work that he and his staff have done to help put this plan together. Not only was there a commitment to put the plan together, but they've also committed to help us with the implementation of this. And as the mayor mentioned in his opening comments, we're looking at potentially a multi-year program here, but certainly getting off with a bang here on the front end. So I did want to recognize that not only the union, but also the council members who helped us understand the needs of the community from your perspective and contributed to the process as well. On the first slide, we're gonna just briefly take a look at our mission. Again, I mean, it's a pretty standard approach. I've tried to put them in layman's terms, if you will. So, because although we have a proposal that addresses the budget issues and improves our response system, our mission pretty much remains the same. And in plain language, we try to teach people to avoid emergencies, wherever possible, help them to prepare for those emergencies in the eventuality that they should occur, and then protect them from harm in any way that we possibly can, and then simply respond when things don't work out. That's a pretty basic concept, and as the mayor indicated earlier, our demand for service is very steady with really some minor fluctuations from time to time, but in general, we've seen a very slow growth, probably based on our population increase over the last decade. I'd also like to recognize this point, that our firefighters that respond on the calls provide an extremely high quality level of service. And that comes a lot from their commitment. This mission is not something taken lightly, as you know, by our organization. We have very committed and dedicated people. And when we respond on calls, we're not really just looking at numbers. We know that we're talking about helping people. And we're helping them with big problems. And we do it many, many times a day. So for the firefighters, I just want to say that we appreciate the great work that they do and certainly the first-class service they provide to citizens of Mesa. Before we go much further, take a look quickly at our response information. Over 53,000 incidents in 2007. You can kind of read these. I can give you some numbers to go with it. I did the math. That 75% EMS related equates to about 39,750 calls a year. The part of that that's basic life support is 23,850, and the percent that's advanced life support is 15,900. We have
maybe we can get into layman's term here too.
Yes.
Difference, so everyone knows the difference between basic life support and advanced life support.
Yes, Mayor, thank you. Basic life support is essentially a non-emergency incident where somebody has a medical problem. Could be as simple as a child falling off a bicycle, breaking an arm, up to a medical complication that people don't understand. That makes up by far the volume of our calls. Many times they will result in a transport to the hospital, many times they won't. The advanced life support component is really the component where we find a non-breather or somebody that's had a heart attack and they need intervention immediately. It also would include, and I have other comments in the presentation on this, but things like major blunt trauma, head injuries, gunshot wounds, incidents that are life-threatening. Thank you for that, Mayor. What we know is when it comes to these numbers is that our aging population is going to really drive a change in service demand, and it's really already occurred. And I would propose that not only will this show up in fire services, but it's going to show up in all the services across the city. Young people tend to be healthy, tend to be active, and although they don't create many medical problems, they do create other problems because they're sometimes mischievous in all levels. Well, as the baby boom generation ages, their health is going to become more of an issue, and they won't be quite as active. And I think we'll see fluctuations in city services reflective of that kind of demand based on that demographic.
Chief, with that demographic, how seasonal are your services? I would assume with winter visitors and things like that, that you have just like the emergency rooms, you have a spike in the winter. How significant is that? And I would imagine that it varies by station also. Some stations who don't have that kind of demographic are pretty consistent, whereas others would have a significant spike in the
winter. That's certainly true. In the west side of the city, things remain pretty constant. We do have some winter visitors that stay in the west side, but most of it occurs in the central city and to the east. And many of the winter visitors that we have are coming here to vacation on low income. So we see more and more calls where they don't have a local doctor, but even with that, they typically depend on emergency rooms and emergency services as the front door to their healthcare system. So we do see spikes in the winter season, and we do see things level off around, you know, February, March, April.
In your career, I mean, I would imagine you bring up an interesting point where the city is, in many cases, has in many cases, has become the primary care physician to a lot of people. You know, that doesn't always, that doesn't only include the older population, but many others as non-insured people and things like that become an issue. How significant or what kind of change have you seen in your career? Is that getting worse? Has that always been the case? Or,
well, you know, that clearly has expanded in the practice. Many years ago when EMS first began, it was a sideline. It was something that really there was no dedicated response system for, and firefighters were in place and positioned within the community to pick up that responsibility. And at that time, it was a relatively low.
And you're talking 15 years ago, 30 years ago, and this is so 25 years ago.
25, 30 years ago.
Okay.
I attended an interesting conference 3 or 4 months ago from a doctor's group talking about the future of healthcare, just to get a different perspective from the doctor's point of view on what's happening with healthcare systems, not only locally but also nationally. And what I learned was that the perception among the doctors was that there has been a national, essentially a plan to refocus medical services into hospitals rather than in doctor's offices. Now, remember, this was a doctor's group who had doctor's offices. So they saw that as a phenomenon that's continued to grow over the years, and certainly that's the case. Many doctors, as you know, cannot practice in hospitals without a contract with that hospital. So with most of the patients going directly to the hospital, you can begin to see the business model that's worked out well for the hospitals. Well, that's the good news. The bad news is the bulk of our population in the baby boom group is now becoming of age, and the time to take people with broken arms to an emergency room may be appropriate for a broken arm. But other ailments and things of that nature where you could go to your family doctor is you're going to see a move back in that direction.
Back to the family doctor?
Yes, over the next 10 years, you're going to see a shift in that because the hospitals simply are not going to be capable of managing that.
I mean, when I was growing up, if you broke your arm, let's say my brother broke his arm,
correct,
there was no 911,
right.
You know, and it wasn't even an option to call some emergency personnel. You know, my mom put my brother in the car and drove to the doctor, or put my brother in the car and drove to an emergency room. But generally, you know, if it was during the day, he drove to the doctor's office. My guess now is that if someone breaks their arm, I don't know of anyone who puts their kid in the car and drives them to the emergency room. Generally, they pick up the phone and call 911, and we end up responding, and then they're either transported after we respond, or they're actually transported by ambulance. So seems like the whole model has changed. So most people end up in the emergency room, or a good chunk of them, after we've become involved in providing a service that 25 years ago we were never involved in. Now, you're saying that the thought is that maybe we're shifting back or that we're going to continue on with the new model.
I'm saying that in the future it will have to. But I don't see
that. How do you force that, though?
Well, it's going to be driven by Congress and the way they structure.
Oh, okay. That's a nice thought.
Yes.
That makes me feel comfortable.
Well, the phenomenon we're talking about, obviously, is nationwide. And we know that the current healthcare system is not broken from the perspective of having trained specialists. It's the allocation of the resource. And so there's going to need to be a shift in that to deal with the higher level emergencies that are on their way. We're going to see many more heart attacks. In this day and age, people don't die from the first heart attack. They may have two or three heart attacks. Strokes are practically curable if there's immediate tension. So people can have multiple strokes. Each of those incidents requires an advanced life support team to respond and has to go to a hospital. So the time when basic life support type patients are clogging up the halls at an emergency room will have to stop. And that will be forced upon the medical community to realign the way they do business. We are an extension of that process. And the plan we have today is going to outline steps that we can take that are going to really position us well, not only to deal with what we have today, but to be positioned well for the future.
Because in reality, while we think it might be forced, for right now, the basic responsibility has fallen in our lap.
That's correct.
People pick up the phone in most any medical emergency, whether it's a sprained ankle or a massive heart attack, the propensity is for someone to pick up the phone and call 911. And when they call 911, you respond.
Almost without exception. I believe that...
So whether we like it or not, we have that responsibility and that obligation, which also means that financial burden.
That's correct.
For right now. Okay. I'm sorry. As Mr. Richens would say, let's get back to the presentation.
He's getting an answer.
We currently have 19 engine companies, 5 ladder companies are running out of 17 stations with 324 on-duty firefighters that respond to calls. That's about a 0.7 firefighters per 1,000 population. I'm sorry,
Vice Mayor.
Understanding that you can't compare apples to apples nationwide because demographics are different, density is different, so the requirements of service are different, but what is the national average of firefighters per 1,000?
Well, it varies according to the demands of the particular
right.
community. For cities our size, it's typically around 1. You'll see some cities, typically larger cities, have a larger firefighter per 1,000. They tend to have larger inner city problems with high call volumes, which is a feature of Mesa, but we're certainly not on the scale of a Phoenix. Phoenix has about 1.2 firefighters per 1,000. We're lower than every other community in the valley, with the exception of Apache Junction, who also has a 0.7 firefighters per 1,000.
Okay, thank you.
And just numbers, if we were up to that 1, would be at about 450, 460?
That's correct.
Okay.
Just as a matter of reminder, and because it's going to be pertinent as we go through the rest of the presentation, each of our engine and ladder companies are staffed with 4 individuals. All of them have advanced firefighter training. They can handle anything from major fires to hazmat spills to technical rescue and everything in between. Major auto accidents, major mass casualty situations. They are really what we call affectionately the A-team. And that's our standard unit for response. Two of the members of each crew are state certified paramedics. They're also toxicology qualified, which is a very unique. It was something we were able to achieve through a grant. But our paramedics are some of the highest trained paramedics in the country. So we are equipped essentially with every one of our units to handle everything from the worst possible case scenario to the most minor type call. And we currently send them on all of the calls. Some of the issues that we're confronted with this is that is our basic model for response to all types of incidents. To get into a little bit of the plan that we're proposing, the first item really addresses a specific need in the Southeast Mesa area. We have seen that area obviously is the fastest growing area of our community, but we have really seen an increase in the number of calls. We've known for some time that our response times are long because of the travel distance between stations. But as we have watched our data, what we have seen is a significant increase, especially in the area just east of the Proving Ground and over to Meridian. It's just been very explosive. One of the priorities that we wanted to address in our plan was to deal with that response problem. So our first move in our plan is going to be reassign our engine 2201, which currently runs out of our station 1 downtown. That will leave an engine and a ladder to run out of that station. So they will lose one of the engine companies. They will go to fire station 217, which will accommodate an additional crew there, and they will begin to serve the residents in that end of the city. Not only will it improve response times in that you'll have essentially twice as many units running out of that station, but it will also reduce the need for a secondary unit to respond down there, which increases the response time. We'll also use that unit very flexibly to move it around in the East Valley, depending on what the call volumes look like or if we have any holes in the system. So it's an important element that we've decided we have to take we have to bite the bullet and deal with that issue immediately.
So if I understand you correctly, right now you have certain engines and certain ladders assigned to certain stations. There's not a lot of mobility or adjusting to permanently or temporarily physically moving a unit to another station. For example, if it is in the winter and you have a higher call volume out of a certain station, which is in an area with winter visitors, you would just cover it from other stations. And what you're saying is with this plan that you'll move them around, perhaps if there is a change in demand, if there is a gap that you're seeing, that you're going to have more flexibility in moving resources between stations. And that's a change in your operating procedure? Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct, Mayor. And flexibility is a key word in our entire plan. One of the goals we have is to create more flexibility in our system so that we can adapt to the different needs.
So whereas in the past, and when I'm talking about the past service model, we might wait until we could permanently add another unit in a certain situation. Right now, we might, or our plan will say, well, you know, that isn't a permanent need. Rather than maintain a permanent gap, we're going to move someone there temporarily to cover that. And then when that is handled or that passes, we're going to move them to another station, and we're going to be a lot more flexible in how we allocate resources around. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, but Mayor and Chief, let's be clear, though. I agree. I think that's generally what will happen. But effectively, what the Chief is doing, and Chief, correct me if I'm wrong, we are literally accelerating the establishment of 219 on the east side.
Well, I understand that, but you're moving an existing unit out of Station 1 out to 19 rather than wait for that to be built and adding another unit.
No, but I just want to make the point that we are putting, we're essentially, you know, without a building being there, we're moving the resources and the manpower out there.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
And to that point, we formerly had an adaptive response company that was basically a fire station without walls. But that, as I understand, concept went away. So this isn't really an adaptive response company, but it is a transfer for resources to an area where there's the greatest need.
That's correct. Councilmember Kavanaugh, in years past, we did have units we defined as adaptive response units. One of their primary purposes was to move around the city and fill gaps. What has happened over time is that unit ended up at our Fire Station 1, and it currently responds on well over 2,500 calls a year by itself at that location. What that means is it effectively, and as Chris Brady mentioned, it effectively puts that unit in that station permanently to deal with the calls in that area. So the adaptive response concept is something that we are planning to reinvigorate, and use of different kinds of vehicles. And at some point, and Dan can correct me here, but as you would imagine with firefighters, we pretty much will go do whatever we need to do to get the job done. And that is going to carry over into the way we manage our resources as well. Virtually every unit in this system at one point in time can be moved to another station as an adaptive unit to infill holes and to balance out the deployment system for the city, especially in the event of a major incident that draws in a lot of resources to one location. So all we're really doing is re-emphasizing that this is a part of the model that we've had for some time, but we're going to expand it a little bit. And in this case particularly, we're simply going to plug that unit in at Station 217 in advance of Station 219, which, as you recall, was a bond-approved new station that we're going to locate at Signal Butte and Elliott. And we're going to accelerate the construction of that station to try to get that station in service, and again, to give us a little more flexibility with additional units. And then we also plan to work with DMB, who has worked with us very closely and with the city on helping to locate a station in the proving ground area where their development will occur to offset the increase in call volume that will occur in that area of town.
Councilmember Richens.
Can you tell talk about how Station 218 fits in the plan and as far as the timeline and building Station 218? Because I know we're pretty well designed along in that station.
That's correct. We have more to discuss with regard to Engine 218, but purposes of construction of fire stations. 218 is a station that is also in the bond, but because of the need in the east side, we have chosen to accelerate the construction of 219. That shouldn't delay Station 218 very much, but it could be as much as 6 months to a year, depending on how the construction schedules work out. Before we go to the next slide, or actually we're on the next slide, let me describe for you the process that we use to respond to 911 calls. I've mentioned it earlier, but we currently send engines in the ladders to every type of incident. We basically have two kinds of incident. We have a fire-related incident and an emergency medical-related incident. So all of our responses are essentially categorized under those two general areas. But what we know in reality is that we have at least four areas of response that we're currently serving. The first one is the obvious high emergencies, which are working fires and advanced life support, which we've discussed earlier. The second are what we call the low emergencies, and they're the most calls that we have in the system. But those are basically the basic life support, non-threatening medical calls, as well as check hazards and other emergency requests that won't necessarily require four people to manage the call. We plan to do that based on the model that the council approved for us a couple years ago, which is the TRV system, the two-person transitional response vehicle that's very, very adaptable. We'll expand their role to be more than just medical and use them to service a whole myriad of other service calls where we believe we need fire service experience to help solve problems. Basically, these are the kind of calls, if they're not medical, is you have to go out and investigate. There's no apparent emergency, but there potentially could be, so we want to go out and investigate. And then we have social services. We have sort of denied that we've been dealing with social services, but the reality is that that's a whole section of calls that we've been going on that we haven't accurately categorized. Sometimes you'll see in our statistics that it looks like our EMS calls are actually going down. Well, that's really not true, but what it is true of is that we have, through our dispatch protocols over the last couple years, revised the nature of those kinds of calls. And we have to, at some point, and it's in the plan, rebuild our data system to collect accurate data about the types of calls that we're going on. But we know that they are a significant element of response, and they're very time-consuming. Social service calls are behavior-oriented types of calls. Literally, people will have a panic attack over anything. We see elderly people who are more and more distraught over trying to make decisions, who live by themselves, who simply need someone to talk to. When we can evaluate that on the front end, then we have a better chance of sending the proper unit to those types of calls. In the past, it's either been sent an engine or a ladder, or ask the person to call somebody else. So it's not been a very functional process, and we plan to remedy that. And then the last area that we know we go on are what we call service calls. And that's basically things like minor flooding in homes. Maybe there's a sparking wire behind a set of appliances. Maybe there's a slight smell of smoke, or there's a strange odor. Nobody really knows what it is. Those would be the kinds of calls that are basically service calls. And again, we currently send an engine or ladder, four-person crew, the A-team, to evaluate those particular calls. Obviously, when they're responding on those types of calls, they're out of service for fires and advanced life support calls. So not only is it probably more resources than we need to send on those types of calls, but when we do that, we take that resource out of the bigger system to respond to the higher level of emergencies.
And Chief, when you go on like a social service call, when is the call? I know when the call begins, but the call doesn't necessarily end when we show up and find out that it's a distraught elderly person, let's say. I mean, how long does the entire crew tend to linger sometimes because they can't just walk away from that person because there is a situation? And how do they handle that?
Well, obviously that varies from call to call, but our current system provides for a volunteer connector van, which is, you can see under social service, is the current method. It is only in service part-time based on the availability of volunteers, and this plan will address the increase.
But until that service van were to show up, you still have that ladder, that truck with four firefighters sitting there waiting for that. So that could be minutes or it could be much, much longer.
That's correct.
Okay. So it creates a burden on the system that goes beyond just the cost of the truck getting out there and the personnel getting out there.
That's correct. Now, with firefighters as they are, they currently monitor other channels, and if a higher level of emergency comes in, especially a very life-threatening one, they'll pull themselves away.
Okay.
And we'll send a backup unit. But in general, basically what you described is exactly right.
Okay.
Not only will this change allow us to send the proper resource to the proper type of call, give us greater flexibility, but it's going to save money, especially in the future. We know that these two areas, social service calls and regular service calls, are a growing part of our business and have been for some time. So we are formally in Mesa going to recognize that that is a component of our service demand, and we're going to manage it differently than we do a fire or a major medical emergency.
Councilmember Summers.
Chief, I'll chime in on this particular slide, but you may be addressing this later. There's an interesting, there's a two-sided problem, I suppose, with regard to the fire department. On one hand, you don't want to tie up an A-team, four-person company on a low-level call for a period of time, the example the mayor gave, which is the hand-holding for a while. Because if another call were to come in that was serious, it's going to need a longer response time for those people. But there's also a problem where it's very difficult on the front end of these calls to determine which call is a high emergency, which one's a low, which one's civil social service, which one's a service call. As a matter of fact, some of them you can determine pretty quickly. I'll give you an example of Chandler, a company I was in, responded to, I believe it came in as alarm sounding or a check fire out. The first crew rounded the corner and it had a plume of smoke showing. It was a TGI Fridays over in Chandler off Array Road. It makes a lovely parking lot right now, not generating a whole lot of sales tax for the city of Chandler. But the issue there was the call came in at a very low level, ended up being a structure fire and two or three alarms. So how the problem is the people that are calling us are not qualified to make the triage decisions. They can't tell the difference between when grandpa is having the flu or a heart attack. They can't tell the difference between just an alarm sounding and sometimes the building being on fire, as evidenced by that example. So how are we going to prepare our incident takers to be able to better triage and pull that information out of there to make the proper dispatch, since we're now talking about sending either a four-person crew or a two-person crew, and depending on which crew, could be the right result or a very bad result?
The next slide is going to address that directly, but let me make a comment about
It is. I didn't cheat on this one. Just look ahead.
But it's good feedback for me that at least I have your attention. We're not in the right direction.
It's a good segue then.
You make a good point, especially when we send volunteers, because we never really, we can never be certain that we get the complete picture from a caller, because as you mentioned, they're really not in a position to give us a proper assessment. We need to do better training on that, and that's part of the plan as well. But it's one of the reasons that we have to do a better job of attracting volunteers that can stay with us longer, because we plan to train them. A caller, someone driving down the street with a cell phone sees a column of smoke, they call the fire department, they report a column of smoke, we can go on that. The volunteers can do the same thing. So it is one of our goals is to cross-train all the people in our system to be able to do a quick triage of what level of response would be appropriate of the four levels I described previously would be appropriate response for that and make that recommendation to the dispatch. So that is a good point.
Is this something where perhaps looking specifically at the connector, if I may follow up, Mayor, we talk about the influx right now, particularly a lot of the snowbirds or winter visitors have come back, and that generates a lot of calls. Are we looking at the possibility of some kind of a seasonal connector volunteer where perhaps, just to pick out an example, Sunland Village has a lot of seasonal folks. They may have a lot of retired pastors or people who are former professionals who actually could fit in very well and maybe just handle their neighborhood so that if 205 gets a call in that area, they can
dispatch them. It's faster and something that they might be able to, willing to do.
We have evaluated the potential for volunteers, and certainly the influx of winter visitors have not missed our attention in terms of trying to have them volunteer on a seasonal basis if they come every year. We pretty much try to employ all comers. Mayor, I'm sorry.
Councilman, you're good? Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Oh, did I get it?
Let's move on to the next slide. Really, this is the heart of the reinvention of the way that we're going to manage our services in the Mesa Fire Department. Clearly, at the front end, we have to do a better job, as Councilmember Summers mentioned, of being able to evaluate the proper resources to send on particular types of incidents. In order for that to occur, we have been working very closely with the police department, actually for several months, to allow that the dispatch component that serves the fire department within the police center right now to become under the supervision of the fire department. We plan at that point to begin training. The first step would be to reassign staff from a current response unit where we have a single person response, whether it be one of our support units such as a light and air utility truck or the command van or another single unit response, to reassign that staff to the dispatch center and allow them to rise to supervisor level so that we would have a 24-hour company officer in the dispatch center that could not only train and support and guide the dispatchers, but could also make major deployment decisions in terms of where we need to move units in this new flexible system, where we need to move units, and how we need to fill the holes in the system, and what's the appropriate unit to resend on a particular call if there's a question. That's a very key part of this whole system being implemented and making an impact. One of the things that, and I might add that the dispatchers who currently work in the police department who have provided this dispatch for us have done a truly outstanding job. This is actually something hopefully that will encourage them to understand that what we're trying to do is take the great job that they've done and try to help them bring it to the new level. We're going to be very dynamic, and it's going to take a lot of cooperation from that staff. They've done a fantastic job. We have very high hopes that this is going to work out extremely well for us. One of the things that we're looking forward to is the ability to interact more directly with the responders from the dispatch center rather than in canned messages, to actually have some dialogue. We're going to need good information transferred back and forth about the nature of the calls so that we be sure that we send the correct unit. This can happen several ways. Typically, when we do a dispatch, unless there's a self-help situation, in other words, someone's going to coach somebody through cardiac resuscitation, we hang up and we take the next call. In the future, we're going to need to stay on the phone a little longer with those people, gather more information, send that information out to the responding units, coordinate with that unit that they indeed are the appropriate unit to respond on that call, send them messages via their mobile computer terminal where they can read it as they go down the road. We're also going to supply and have begun to supply the actual telephone number of the person who called in the incident so the responding units can call that person back and talk to them while they're en route to that emergency. There's technology out there that can really help us today better than ever before be sure that we're sending the right resources to the particular type of incident that's occurred.
Chief, do you currently have in place any type of tracking system or information or database that analyzes whether you had the proper deployment to an incident? For example, if you do have a call that comes in and you, well, I guess you wouldn't because you're deploying the same equipment basically to everyone. Let me backtrack. Maybe in the future, I would hope that we'd have some sort of incident tracking system that would say that would see how effective we are in deploying the right equipment to the right emergency.
Mayor, you're right on track with the last item on this slide. We need to implement a process where we can determine whether what we sent originally was correct versus what they really needed when they got there. Right now, we we describe the type of call we're responding to based on the way it's dispatched. We need to have a disposition at the end of the incident to allow us to know whether or not the judgment call on the front end matched the need on the street, and then we can analyze the breakdowns between in the process.
Yeah, one of the challenges that I see being a non-professional in this area is that there's always the one or two or three or however many there are, you know, exceptional stories. You know, Councilmember Summers brings up one where you think you're going to find one thing and you show up and see another. But we had over 50,000 calls last year. I mean, it would be nice to know if that, you know, were one or two incidences a year, or if there are 50 or 100 incidences a year where that happens. My guess is that that does happen and will always happen to a certain degree. But the challenge we have is allocating resources that recognize that we're not going to be able to cover every single instance that we encounter during a year, because by doing that we might leave a gap that leaves 500 other incidences uncovered. So I'd hope that as we go forward we can fine-tune that, because we're going to get into a situation where allocating resources, providing resources, is a big problem right now. Allocating those resources, as I hear you, is going to be even more essential in the future. And as we get this flexibility, being able to decide how good of a job we're doing in allocating those resources. And in order to do that, we have to have an information system to track the success and failure of those responses.
That is absolutely correct. We went from a basic system where four people go on every truck to every call, and there's only two basic types, fire and EMS, to a system where we're looking at many more different types of units, a lot more options to maximize the efficiency, and the need to have information not only passed much more quickly and accurately between the players, but then a good metric system to measure how well that system performs.
Well, as I'm hearing you so far, not only does it improve efficiency, because sometimes that gets people's hair stand up when you talk about efficiency in public service, because they think you're sacrificing service. And what I'm hearing is that you're not only being more efficient, but you're actually expanding your service area and your capabilities by becoming more efficient in certain areas. And I'd just like to be able to track that and see how that works, because I think that if this works out long-term, what you've described so far, we can actually expand our coverage, reduce times, and also do it in a more cost-effective manner, which is certainly a win-win situation.
No question. And the efficiency that I'm referring to has to do with whether or not we sent the proper resource to the proper call. And for as many times as we have a greater emergency than we anticipated, we will have a much lesser emergency than we anticipated as well. So the measurement needs to occur on both sides of that spectrum. And to this point, we really haven't broken it down in the four categories I mentioned and begun to analyze it from that perspective. So this is a very key component. And another reason why we need to get involved in managing the dispatch center for fire and EMS response immediately.
This question.
Councilmember Higgins.
Chief, is that require like a lot of EMS training? Is this like a couple months as opposed to like a day and a half for other dispatch? I mean, there's a big difference between this, right? I mean, your dispatchers, if properly trained, will be able to do correct triaging and send the right resources. But how are we able to take the dispatchers today and train them, send them off for a couple months, or what's the plan? I think I missed that part.
Of course, we will be able to train our current dispatchers. They're completely capable. Having said that, there are some systems where they have EMT certified people in the dispatch center, and that's a requirement to maintain employment. There are other systems that require a one-time certification of EMT and significant algorithms that they use to ask a set of questions to determine the proper response. That's probably one of the greatest challenges we're going to have to modify to this four-incident system, if you will, is we need to create algorithms that help the dispatchers ask the right set of questions that lead them to the correct second question, and at the end of the day, they can push a button and it'll tell them what the proper resource is. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done there, and you can see that we have a long way to go to actually achieve that. So in the meantime, it's even more important and critical that we have experienced public safety people in the dispatch center, not only to initiate the training, but to coach them and help them through questionable situations.
So basically what you're saying is the ability to ask the right questions to extract information out of that person who's panicked and calling in and isn't going to volunteer or doesn't know what information to volunteer, our dispatch people can, through these series of questions, extract out the information they need to make a determination of what's really going on there.
That's
and
exactly
send the right resources out.
That's exactly okay. Correct.
But Mayor and Chief, let's not forget, though, one of the things we're doing, though, the training for the existing employees is critical, but we're actually adding additional high-level resources
right.
into dispatch
That's
to
correct.
Supervise, which we don't have today.
That's correct.
So that quality control or oversight will be significant.
And once again, the idea, and unless people not misunderstand by adding high level that we're just adding a layer on, the idea is to allocate the proper resources, which are more efficient, more cost effective, and we're making an investment through those highly trained personnel this so we can save and actually not only save money and save resources, but we can actually get the proper resources in the right place so we can save lives.
That's the goal, exactly. Some systems actually will have a paramedic assigned who will do self-help. In other words, if there's a bleeding incident and somebody needs to be coached on how to control bleeding while we're en route, those kinds of things are also, depending on the type of system that you have and depending on your response times, sometimes that's appropriate too. But Mayor, this is really a developmental area for us. As you mentioned at your outset, there's a lot of questions that we can't even answer at this point, but we have many more questions than we have answers at this point. But we know that this is the right direction to go in. And again, when I speak of efficiency, I'm talking about making sure that that advanced life support unit is available when we have a life advanced support patient, as well as that fire company is available to respond to big fires when we have a big fire and they're not on something that they shouldn't be. To continue with the reinventing our deployment system, we're not going to go back to the two-person paramedic unit of the 70s when, I can't even think of the guys' names now, but when Rescue 51 was responding in California out of Rampart Hospital. It's Gage and DeSoto. I knew Terry would know that. We are not going to go back. That model was essentially an experiment back in those days to see what it would take to get into emergency medicine. And we found, unfortunately, 15 years later, that sending six people to that incident wasn't not necessary. That's how come Mesa converted to putting two paramedics on every engine company and did away with the rescue trucks. Again, that was an efficiency step to eliminate two people from the scene of an incident that weren't necessary. What we're talking about now is not converting back to that old system, but to actually take the next step, which is to say, do we need to have paramedics on all types of calls that we're going on, or can a lesser level of trained individual actually competently and effectively handle that call? So that's sort of the basis of the TRV system. Again, I want to thank Council for the opportunity a couple years ago to actually pilot this. It gave us an opportunity to do quite a bit of evaluation and research. The feedback from firefighters is the TRV program has been very successful in accomplishing the goals we set out. And it's a model that I believe you will see expanded not only here in Mesa, but in other areas of the country. It just makes too much sense. In order for us to actually continue with TRVs, as you recall, you may recall, we did discontinue our TRVs several months ago to reevaluate and do some redeployment, calculate some redeployment ideas for this. And so at this point, we do not have them in service every day, but we are proposing that we will convert engine 218, who currently runs out of station 3, to two TRVs that will operate 24/7. One of those units will go to station 203 to backfill for 218 because we want to maintain the basic life support component at that station. As we said, that's the highest volume of calls that we have out of every fire station. So we're going to be able to backfill that component at that location. And then the second unit we will put at station 201 to backfill for the displacement of 2201 that's going to go to station 217, if you can follow me in that transaction.
Yeah, Vice Mayor.
So what would be your timeline then for if you transition 218 out, that once we build 218 the station, time frame wise, to put another engine back into the new station? We're looking 3 years. What's your anticipation?
Well, it could be anywhere from 2 years to 2.5 years in that neighborhood is kind of what we've talked about. But certainly the day that station is constructed, we want to be in a position to put staff there. One of the things we haven't covered yet, but in our plan, we have transferred or reassigned 9 sworn positions who currently work on staff back to the
field.
And those 9 positions essentially create 3/4 of the staffing necessary to put in another engine at some point if we needed to, which we will. So we're going to transition them back over a period of time, so we're going to have to evaluate that as we go. But clearly, when Station 218 is ready to roll, we need to have a company in there to respond to calls.
So this is just a temporary to free up the cash flow right now?
That's correct.
And then you know that you're going to have to put that engine back into the new station in a couple of years?
Yes, that's correct.
Councilmember Summers.
Operational question for our automatic aid partners in Tempe. 203 frequently goes into Tempe on calls. For their BLS calls that come in, are we going to be able to send the
English?
TRB?
BLS.
Basic life support.
I know.
When somebody stubs their toe in Tempe and calls 911, can we send the 2-person unit, or is the automatic aid agreement going to require that we send engine 203?
The automatic aid agreement will put us in a position to send a 4-person company because that's the system that was in place.
Can we revisit that system? Because my understanding is that Tempe's ambulance response is different than our ambulance response as far as capabilities.
There are several nuances that we evaluate all the time in that particular location, both regarding ambulances, regarding high call volumes at elderly care centers, the fact that they don't have paramedics on their ambulances and we do. There's a whole myriad of issues there that we're constantly working on. But I really believe that the plan that we're going to put forward is going to become something that's somewhat of a model. And we believe that at some point, the automatic aid system, in fact, the meetings I've had with the Life Safety Council, the Regional Life Safety Council, I'm on the board of directors there, and the fire chiefs have embraced this model as a model that they want to look at valley-wide. So it could at some point become a part of the valley-wide system. But to be more specific, that will continue. There will be a period of time where we're going to have that difficulty. But having said that, when we are out of service and we have an advanced life support call, the unit in Tempe could very easily respond into Mesa to fill that vacancy. So, and if that wasn't available, maybe a unit from Gilbert would be closer to come in and actually take that call. So it's always going to be an AV. We have GPS systems on all the fire trucks. We're always going to send the closest, most available, or most appropriate unit.
Yeah, and I don't think that you'd get any one on here that would object if you revisited some of these nuances, as you say,
yes,
in differences, because while we appreciate the crossover service agreements, we also want those to be on a more equitable and even basis. And I know that differs because they're different standards, but we need to take care of what our problems and challenges are and see what we can do to adjust to accommodate those arrangements within our capabilities, rather than maintaining over capabilities just to meet somebody else's under capabilities. I hope I said that politically correctly. So,
well, just as a comment, that problem is being addressed now as we look at redeploying those stations 218 and then a new 203. So we will be that will become less of a problem over time just for our updating our systems. So.
Councilmember Richens.
I know citywide, I think you said 75% of our emergency calls are medical related. How many on the first station 203 and 201, which are west side stations? What's the percentage of medical calls from those stations?
They're very high, probably 80%, if I recall. That particular area of town will have a little higher level of demand for our services simply because the socioeconomic conditions there. But what we know is that at least 60% of those, maybe higher, are going to be basic life support calls. And so what we want to be able to do is send the TRV on those calls to keep the other unit available where it can, which is what we do now with 218. So I guess what I'm saying is most of the time when 218 is out of service right now, it's out of service for a BLS call, our basic life support call. In the future, we won't have a four-person fire unit out of service. We'll have a two-person TRV out of service servicing the same call. So on balance, it's a slight trade-off, but I believe that we're able to manage that in a way that doesn't reduce services in that
area. Chief, I know you don't have the numbers right in front of you, but I, for some reason, took a special interest in some of these areas around that. I think in some of the square mile grids, those calls are actually over 95% medical in the West Mesa area.
It varies throughout the city. It varies throughout the time of year. And it's something that we work with averages in general, but clearly when we're going to be modifying our system to be more flexible and more responsive to needs, we're going to begin to evaluate those particular areas as key components in the decision-making process about what's the appropriate unit to assign.
Yeah, because I think that what I'm seeing here is that you're actually, whereas the at first blush, it might think that, wow, we're getting under allocated, you're actually doing a response to meet what the real need is, and it's a very concentrated need for medical service in this area. And you actually, by doing this, you're actually fulfilling that need in a much more directed manner, because you basically have doubled the number of units by putting two TRVs there that can respond to medical emergencies.
So the engine, so the company on engine 218 is getting split in two for the two TRVs at 203 and 201. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct.
And then the actual engine 218, what's happening with that?
It will become one of our reserve apparatus until we need it frontline again.
Okay, thank you.
I might make note too. Think of it this way. This clarified it for me. Let's say that in our city, we're on at least four active incidents all the time. We're on four calls all the time. If our stats are correct, 75% of those are going to be EMS calls. So three of those four-person engine companies are going to be out of service on a medical call and unavailable for a fire call. With the TRV system, and remember, 60% of those are basic life support calls. So with the TRV system in place, we're able to service those with a lower level unit, thus allowing the fire company at that station to be more available for fires and advanced life support types of calls. And if you think about it, the basic life support calls, again, we're going to be looking at this from lots of different ways. Maybe our response times don't say the same for basic life support. With the TRVs, we have expanded the response radius from a 1.5 mile radius to a 5 mile radius, because some of those incidents do not require, they're driving without red lights and siren already, they don't require a 5 minute turnaround. They could be a 10 minute turnaround, and it really wouldn't evolve into any additional damage or disadvantage for the customer. So what we're doing is we're bringing the fire service to a new age where we're going to use more technology, more analysis, increase the flexibility, and when I say efficiency, I mean allow us to have the proper units for the proper call available when that call comes in.
Chief, let's do this. We're holding you up quite a bit, and we're extending some of that. I'm more guilty than any others, so I apologize for that. Why don't you go through and the rest of the presentation, and then we'll ask questions.
Some of the things that we plan to do with the TRVs is to put our surplus heart monitors on them, which would allow the paramedic on that unit to do a cardiac evaluation if necessary, and be able to call for resources very quickly. It also has the ability to cardiovert or to convert somebody who is in fibrillation. So if in event that they show up on a call that was evaluated on the front end, they're capable of saving a life immediately if that situation should occur. We're also going to really encourage the use of our continuous cardiac resuscitation program, which we helped pioneer with the University of Arizona and is now becoming a standard, at least in Arizona. Even Phoenix is beginning to use it. And it's going to become a national standard as well as soon as the American Heart Association recognizes it and begins to use it. And then we implement the TRVs we're going to implement additional TRV units at three additional stations citywide. We're going to analyze their proper location for this type of unit based on the type of calls that they have from that station. And what we will do is organize the resources in such a way that if a basic life support call comes in, the crew will split automatically two people, a paramedic and an EMT, will respond to the basic life support call, leaving the other two behind to respond on additional basic life support calls and if they should come in while the first unit is on the call. We think it doubles our ability to deal with basic life support, which is, again, 60%. It's a high percentage of our overall call demand and the highest amount of number of calls that we go on. We want to expand the use of the physician's assistants that we've experimented with in the TRV program. We got nothing but favorable comments from really everybody involved in that. It does allow us to relieve situations in emergency rooms where we have overcrowding. The TRV units will be capable of transporting people to an urgent care if they need to be, rather than to an emergency room where they can see a doctor. Physician's assistants are able to write prescriptions on the scene, so rather than having repeat calls for a condition because the person doesn't have a family doctor to go to get a prescription, they're able to get treated and alleviate their problems and not have to call us back and not have to go to the emergency room. So we really see that as a real benefit in terms of service. But looking on the other side, as licensed physician's assistants, they are capable of charging for several of their services. We are working with a doctor's group now to evaluate where that could be appropriate in our response system and try to negotiate with them a process where we can offset the cost of the two people that we would normally have on a TRV by having some of the fees recovered for service be a part of the contract that pays the doctor group. And, you know, this plan in general, this is the final slide in the deployment plan. This represents a very bold reinvention of our deployment and response system. We believe it's going to be very effective, and it really represents a state-of-the-art model. Obviously, we are still going to be in a test mode. We are not going to implement components of this until we feel very certain that we aren't going to compromise anybody's health or safety. I think that hopefully that goes without saying. Another item that we have already implemented on the next slide is to convert our centralized department training to battalion level training. It allows us to reassign several of our sworn positions who can conduct that centralized training back to the field. The battalion chiefs and their battalion safety officers are anxious and willing, as well as the companies, to have a battalion level training that will allow them to stay in their first two areas or in the vicinity without having to drive to a central location, essentially moving them out of position for deployment. So they will always be, with some minor exceptions, available for a response even during training. We really look forward to expanding our ability to do video-based training, or I should say,
help me with that term.
Teleconferencing, yeah. as an important feature. It will essentially allow us to do centralized training when we have to without having to bring companies in. It's a very inexpensive way to do training. It maintains consistency in the training. One of the problems with decentralization is maintaining consistency. And when you're in the business that we're in, accuracy is extremely important because it can be important in a decision that can cause, you know, either somebody's life or destruction of property.
Chief, earlier on in your presentation, you talked about those roving units. I think you call them what, ARUs. Those, in many cases, the gaps they were filling, as I understand it, were for units that were out of the station in training. And one of the reasons, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're able to eliminate those units is by going to more of a on-duty battalion level training. They will not be physically removed in as many instances because they will be available, as you said, for that. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. And having access to the dispatch center and having experienced people in there to make decisions about how to move those units up and which ones to move up are also going to help compensate for that.
Vice Mayor?
As I understand, talking to you before, Chief, also, some of that training would just take place in the station as opposed to going to a centralized place. So they're still there, and if a call comes, they can suspend the training and take off if they need to.
Exactly right.
Councilor Higgins?
Does that mean we no longer have the Firefighter Academy for new recruits? No, that's two different things.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. I'm sorry for that confusion, but yes, we're going to continue to need staff to do new hire training, although actually we're going to incorporate fire companies into that more often too as they go through their first year probation. So we're integrating everybody into the system, and it's going to get very active.
Councilmember Kavanaugh. With regard to training, one of the elements of our cable franchise system was the public safety channels for training purposes. Are those functional? Are you able to use those now, or is that something you have to use in the future to be able to train your folks within the stations from a central location?
That's a very good question. And for some of you who didn't know, we do have access to public safety cable channel through our negotiations with, I believe, Cox. We have not had the opportunity to access the use of that channel because of the infrastructure necessary and some of the devices that we would need to put in the fire stations. We've literally looked at this every year for probably 10 years. Chief Bradbury has been involved in it for that long. It made sense then. It makes sense now. But there's a capital investment that actually has come down. We estimated at one point it'd be $500,000 to set ourselves up to do that. It appears it may have come down to maybe as low as $200,000 to $250,000. So it's the time is past for us to do that, but we're going to have to engage ourselves and actually put that together. We plan to expand our fire and life safety education program to begin to do a lot more action with regard to 911 education. As I mentioned before, our model is going to require people with a little higher education in terms of how to describe the nature of their emergency. Rather than just call up and say, is it fire or medical, which is the way the question is asked now, there's going to be many more questions that are going to be asked. And so we're going to try to teach people that when you access the fire department, be prepared to provide certain types of information when you call in. Now, we understand that they're not always thinking clearly, but many times when it's a third party that's making the call, they're much more capable of providing information, and that training would pay dividends for us. We're also looking at expanding that education into EMS prevention. We already do quite a bit of that, but with our child care program in particular, our child safety training program, I should say, but with our seniors in particular, it's important for people to know that when they lift something, they should bend their knees and not lift with their back. I mean, it's a pretty simple thing, but I think the more we can inundate through training and education, I think the better chance we have of reducing injury, and quite frankly, reducing or eliminating injuries and fires is really our primary mission. Response is essentially a reflection of a failure somewhere on somebody's part, somewhere in the system. And then finally, emergency preparedness. It's a natural now that emergency preparedness was a very unique a challenge for us when we right after September the 11th. It's at a point now where it's been developed in such a way that it can be carried to the community through our regular public education group who are really high caliber group of people. So we're looking forward to that. The other thing that we're evaluating there, because there are going to be some costs associated with that, but we're looking closely and have been doing some work in partnering with private enterprise to assist with sponsorships for particular trainings where a particular business would like to be associated either with us or with the nature of the training that we're going to extend and would be willing to support us financially in doing that. So we're looking at a lot of different ways to really provide the level of service we need and involve the community who it's really supporting in a major way. We want to expand the volunteer program. We mentioned that a little earlier. We definitely have a challenge to improve our recruitment. We do need to have retention of the volunteers. We cannot have high turnover, which is typical of volunteer groups. What we feel we need to do is provide some sort of sensible incentive or some sort of reason why it makes sense to volunteer with the city of Mesa rather than volunteer someplace else. It can be very simple. Anywhere from free car washes to somebody who's willing to donate it for volunteers, clear up to other measures that we could take. So we do need to look at a way, quite frankly, if we could get every retired school teacher to volunteer at the Mesa Fire Department and work in the public education program on a part-time basis as a volunteer, what a fantastic thing that would be. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, when you look at what's happening demographically and the aging of the population, look at what's happened to our schools locally. It's beginning to evolve before our eyes. There's elements of this aging population cropping up everywhere.
Councilmember Kavanaugh. Thank you, Chief. One of the comments from our Citizen Corps meeting earlier this year, which is really through police and fire, was, again, looking at the ways to encourage and coordinate volunteers within the community. And one of the suggestions of our panel members is that the city consider having a central point, a central person for volunteers. I know that each of the divisions that we have volunteer coordinators. But as you mentioned, and as our core council mentioned, we have a big pool of baby boomers or retired people with a lot of skills that at least our Citizen Corps Council is recommending that we explore ways to make volunteering for the city easier, to make sure the public understands the needs for volunteers within the community. And it may be something that, as a council, we look to provide some investment to have a focal point of contact to fan out to the various departments for the needs that you have. But that came from our core council panel. Thank you.
Vice Mayor?
And I in no way want to diminish the service of those who are giving us our volunteer right now. We have hundreds who are volunteering and do a tremendous job for us.
Absolutely right.
But in these economic times, we need to look for ways to expand that volunteerism. So I want to make sure nobody misunderstands. We really appreciate those who are doing so much for us now.
Councilmember Higgins.
To continue with the Vice Mayor's thought, you showed us a presentation before where the Connector program saved almost $750,000 for the fire department.
Correct.
To me, this is one of those things where you spend a little money to get a huge return. So, I mean, if I saw a plan that actually added another half a person to make it a whole person who does that, I don't have a problem with that. That only makes good financial sense to spend a one position to actually gain, even if you can get that $1.5 million and keep more firefighters in deployment. Thank you.
It really is an arena that we should probably all explore more. It's a huge resource out there that is practically untapped. So I appreciate your comments. And I want to echo what Councilmember Jones said. The volunteers we have right now have been absolutely fantastic. There's the only incentive for these people to come forward, and they do consistently, there's well over 100 of them that work our connector units, is simply to go out and help other people. And you couldn't find a better group of people anywhere, you know, in the world. So, and I've met with them personally as a group and told them of our plans and told them it's because of the great work that they've done and the groundwork that they've laid that this growth is possible. So, again, I'd like to echo what Vice Mayor Jones said. Moving on to other actions that we plan to pursue is really expanding the distribution of automatic electronic defibrillators, which, as you may know, is a very small device that's been invented in the last several years that allows really somebody with very little training to convert somebody who's in the process of having a heart attack. It just makes good sense for us to have those out there. We already have several. It's difficult to manage them, because obviously you have to have trained people and you have to make sure the battery's charged. You know what it is when you have devices that need batteries that you don't use very often. Somebody needs to check them if they're going to be functional when you need them. So that's an area that we plan to expand and also look for grant opportunities there. We believe we can probably find some grants that will help us purchase these units. Again, the challenge is going to be managing them, and maybe that's something a volunteer can do for us as well. And then finally is the budget reductions that we've outlined for you today. These changes will occur in addition to making these reductions. As I mentioned before, this process reassigns three staff chiefs, five captains, and one engineer back to the line, back to the firefighting responsibilities. And it really puts us in a position to make some of these cuts. As you can see, I won't read the numbers for you, but it's a fairly significant number of positions that we will attrition, 23 over this period of time, both with, we do have members that are still in the drop program that we've been able to project out that will retire in this period of time. So we're fairly comfortable that we'll be able to eliminate those positions in this period of time. If the council approves of this plan, we will move on it, elements of it rather quickly. Some of the components are longer term, as we've discussed, take some more development. We will do this in a very methodical, purposeful kind of way. Nobody is going to be put at a disadvantage as we transition to this program. I appreciate the support the council has given us on the TRVs. It's really made a lot of this evaluation and a lot of the thought processes here possible, and we're really counting on your support in the future to bring the whole thing to fruition. That's all I have, Mayor.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? I'd like to thank you for and echo what Mr. Brady said in the beginning, for putting a lot of effort into a program that really does, I think, change our approach and takes into account the need to really change our service model while not sacrificing our ability to serve the citizens of Mesa. And I think the work that you've done with the employers, the firefighters, and the time you've put in, and I know from talking during this method with both of you, or during this process with both of you, that there was a lot of consternation, there was a lot of discussion, an open and honest discussion, and focusing on, once again, recognizing the challenge that we have, not just the budgetary challenge, but what you talked about, the change in demographics, the change in demands on the city, and the fact that we really need to change our service model. And I think this is a great first step, and you're all to be commended. I agree with you. We recognize that this is a beginning, but I think it's a very significant beginning and a very significant change in the mindset that there is only one way to do something, that there are various ways that we can fill those service needs while still maintaining both fiscal responsibility and a service responsibility. So I appreciate the work that's gone in, and we really look forward to seeing how this thing rolls out. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Brady.
Yes, Mayor, Council. Really, what I'd like to do today, just for real quickly here, I know we're kind of long on time or short on time, is we have I think we're going to hand out just a comprehensive or specific listing of the cuts that are being proposed by each specific department, so you can see those. The reality is, while we've not had an opportunity to bring every department in front of the council, you have seen the majority from a dollar perspective of the reductions. If you just include the operations side, what's being proposed of the almost $61 million in cuts, we've already reviewed $34 million of that. And then if you include the compensation adjustments, which includes the cost of living adjustments and the merit pay, that's another $14 million. So we've covered about $48.5 million worth of the total $60 million. The additional areas of reductions focus mostly on the administrative side. There are a few other operating departments in here, such as municipal courts and economic development, but most of those are reductions that are related to their administrative support overall. So we just wanted to share this with you. I think I've also want to share with the council that we do not anticipate that we will receive the funding from the LTAF funding that was committed to us by the governor's office earlier in the year in the budget, and we assumed that $800,000 would be available to the city. Now that appears that no longer will be the case, that is another $800,000 in lost revenues on top of what we've been presenting and discussing so far. We would propose that that shortfall be addressed with one-time dollars from the sale of land over the last year. In addition, it is also proposed that we extend the dial-a-ride on a citywide basis for the remaining fiscal year to allow the council to spend some time during that same period of discussing the transit policy for Mesa. We know that we have discussions coming shortly about the extending light rail, BRT, and really we think that would be appropriate then to have that discussion as it relates to dial ride and all the other services that are available to provide for that service. So that to do that would be about $230,000. So we would propose that those would be some changes to what we've already presented today as we move forward for consideration next week. Thank you.
Councilmember Summers.
Chris, you and I already had this discussion. I I appreciate all the work you've put into helping with the transportation services, and I support the use of those dollars, though I would say that selling an asset and using that money just generally for operating expenses is bad fiscal policy. The only reason that makes sense in this particular case is we're looking for a six-month transition on Gilbert Road as we move the Gilbert Road bus route from a Mesa route to a regional route. So we need to bridge that gap there. And the Dial-A-Ride will continue to be in servicing the growing parts of East Mesa will continue to be a challenge. So just using some money up front to give us 6 months to find alternatives is also a sound. So again, thank you very much for the effort you put forward in helping with that problem.
And Mayor, so provide this information next week. We know we had talked about not having a meeting after this week, but we'll come back on the 18th. If members of council have any questions about what you've already heard or other areas, please let me know during the week. We simply would be asking for a direction from council on moving forward with these adjustments now, especially those that impact the remainder of the fiscal year. But we also remind the council that while we certainly anticipate moving forward with these adjustments going into beginning now, we want to continue to have a dialogue with council as we go into our normal, I guess, I don't know what normal is anymore, our typically calendared budget process. And we anticipate that even items that have been discussed today, you know, we had a great discussion on development services. We would hope we continue to have that conversation and evaluation and expect that we'll be able to come back to council over the next months through January, spring, and then as we get ready to adopt the budget and review all of these going forward, and maybe other departments, obviously, that we'd have a chance to meet with.
Councilmember Summers.
Chris, on this list, what is MPA?
Oh, it's our Management and Performance Accountability Office. They conduct, they're kind of my performance team that goes around and make sure our performance measures are being adhered to and developing performance measures throughout the city.
Vice Mayor.
Could we also get on each of these FTE reductions a percentage of what that reduction is, just for perspective for each department?
Oh, okay. Sure, okay.
Because numbers are great, but a perspective of what that actually did to that department is very helpful.
Yeah, we can do that. Would you like that for the budget or just for the FTEs?
Both.
Okay. You can do that.
There's some other issues that I don't think we're going to resolve today or next week that I think we'll want to bring up. So since we're long on time, we won't bring it up today. But if the next week, over the next week, if you have some things, things that individual council members have certainly brought up to me that we have not yet discussed, let's come prepared next Thursday to discuss those and let Chris know beforehand. I understand that once again, we're not going to resolve and solve every problem in the world.
No, it'd be very helpful for next week if there are items that you would like us to start, saying we want to address this during the next the budget process.
That's what I want to
give us that heads up. That'd be absolutely
Well,
great.
I think we need to, because I think there are some issues that are significant enough, and there have been questions raised that we understand that we can't prolong this to take care of every question, and that many of those questions will be addressed, and those issues will be addressed during what you would call the normal or abnormal budget process. But I think we need to, if we're going to give specific direction on this, we probably need to at least have those issues on the table make sure that we make this decision within the context of, this is a stopgap right now in many cases. But we need to be aware of these things that we're going to take care of over the next 3 or 4 months that we at least need addressed.
And Mayor, what I would also suggest for the council is that when we come back early in the new year, is that we also go back and we bring back, because this we've kind of gotten ourselves delayed, frankly, and the Nalbandians would be very upset that we've not followed up on our strategic initiatives with the council, and I feel like we need to do that.
Yes.
And I think that may be helpful in the context of what we're going through here, And so we would like, I'd like to bring those back to council because that may be a good context to start having a discussion early first as you then look about how do you want to move forward in giving us.
Well, I think that's an essential context
yeah.
because how we should be making decisions, and I get worried when we throw out numbers, and I've talked about FTEs and numbers and things like that, but when we purely look at numbers, we lose sight of objectives and of principles.
Right.
And that's easy to do, and that happens quite a bit. And the council set this strategic plan, and that's really our definition of what our priorities are, what our objectives are, and what our principles are. And I think that long-term, some of the decisions we make, they need to be made within that context.
Yes.
And those should guide us in how we make specific number
right.
decisions.
And the staff looks at those when we try to bring back
yeah.
recommendations.
Well, the citizenry, everyone should understand that if we believe that this is a high value, that our budget decisions are made in accordance with that, not that we back into the value.
Right.
And that's the natural, that's the human tendency to do, is to look strictly at numbers to meet a certain goal, which you have to do, and then you hope you back into your values. I'd really like to emphasize and concentrate with this, what we call a top-down, or what I call a top-down approach, that we look at our principles and that we, as we apply those principles and those priorities, that the byproduct or the result is the reductions, the improvements in efficiencies, the changes in service models, which result in these numbers. And I know that it doesn't perfectly work that way. Sometimes you just got to go to the numbers. But I hope that as we go forward, that we keep those values and those strategic initiatives at the forefront.
Mayor,
yes.
If you don't mind, just a couple of things. One, again, a reminder, if you do have anything you need an answer on by next Thursday, if you can get those to us fairly quick so we can get the research done. The second thing is the second page of your sheet is the most recent sales tax summary. Just want to make sure you saw that. October was a difficult month for us, continuing that string of difficult months in terms of retail activity. But I believe, and Chuck will correct me if I'm wrong, but this falls into the projections that Chuck had forecasted for the remainder of the year when he came to you on the 20th of November. So it's within our projection range, even though those are very depressed projections, if you will.
Well, actually, October looks like it was a little bit better than some of our previous months.
Yeah, Mayor, the thing that's scary about these numbers, though, if you look at just the percentage, though, of where retail and restaurants are,
yeah.
that's really scary for us. So, but you're right. Overall, correct. We're as a percent total percentage, we're hoping for a good greener
Merry Christmas.
A greener Christmas.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Item number two on the agenda is appointments to boards and committees. We have some vacancies in our in many of our boards, and due to people moving out of the city, people resigning from the boards for other reasons, as a mid-year adjustment, I propose 11 new appointments. We've tried to create a wide variety of. Although you really say you want a mix of differences of views, points, and opinions, we've really reached out and tried to get a variety of different types of people on this so we can truly get a cross-section of the community. So I'm proposing these appointments to you, and I'll entertain a motion to approve these if you can. Moved by Councilmember Rich and second by Councilmember Higgins. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, those are approved. The next item is here reports and meetings and conferences attended. We've skipped this the last two or three meetings. If there's anything that's important, Councilmember Higgins.
I just wanted to thank everyone for coming out to the District 5 pancake breakfast last Saturday, and we collected 234 pounds of food for the United Food Bank. So we're very happy and thankful, and thanks for coming out.
Good, thank you. Vice Mayor?
There were a few of us at the Police Academy graduation, the last one for a while. We hope that will be short-lived, but we had that Police Academy graduation. Class 31, there were 31 graduates. They weren't all ours. They were from six agencies, but we had the bulk of them, and we will be having a Fire Academy graduation this Friday night.
So. Okay. Thank you. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
I want to comment on an event that a number of us, including you, Mayor, attended Monday, the unveiling of the first of the art wrap program for our traffic control boxes. This is a public art program that is really came forth from the private sector in our transit corridor along Main Street using a new technology that's like bus wraps, but it's kind of graffiti proof, and using many local artists. We have a number of these public art projects that are in the process of being installed right now, and it's reflective of our community. The West Mesa CDC was the primary force in moving this forward and obtaining private sponsorship for it, but I also want to compliment the city in working with the CDC to make this happen. And one of our group here had the idea, and I just want to compliment Mr. Richens for a great idea that is taking functional city property and transforming it into both wayfinding and identification of our neighborhood and the transit corridor.
Thank you. And I'd like to echo that. Thank you, Councilmember Richens. Who has taken a great interest. If you notice, go by and see many bridges that now have festive colors on them. Mr. Richens and many of his cohorts were instrumental in that, too. So thank you so very much. We appreciate that.
So you're the tagger?
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Brady, schedule meetings.
Thank you, Mayor. Just want to give you an update on our doing business with Mesa event that we had, our open house that we had this past week on Tuesday. We actually had a really great turnout. We appreciate the help of the Mesa Chamber of Commerce, Mesa NEDCO, the Small Business Development Center. We appreciate the coverage that we got. We had a really good turnout. We saw a lot of interest. People were showing up even before we opened our doors, and we were able to get a lot of businesses signed up and follow up with our departments. We had several departments that were there to meet with potential vendors. So we think it was a great success, and we're looking forward to doing it again shortly as word gets out. And one thing we did learn, though, is we need to move the hours up earlier than we had. But other than that, it was a great success. So we look forward to doing that. And then just a reminder to the council, upcoming meetings, we have Wednesday, December 17th at 8 a.m. is the Audit and Finance Committee meeting. And then, of course, as we mentioned, a week from today, we'll have our final council meeting study session of the year, December 18th at 7:30. And then for everyone, to reminder of December 27th, Saturday, December 27th, will be the light rail grand opening celebration from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and that'll be at the Sycamore Transit Center. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Richens.
Do we have January council meetings calendar already?
Yes, we do. We'll forward those to you.
Thanks.
Ms. Crocker, is there any request to speak from the citizens?
No request, Mayor.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion to move into executive session then.
So moved.
Motion by by Vice Mayor Jones, second by Councilmember Summers. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We're now we'll move into executive session.